Good evening, September 18th, 2008. James McCanny here with my Science Hour at the crossroads as usual. And the main science topics tonight, by the way, will be chemistry in outer space and the star-like nature of Jupiter and Saturn. And if you have my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes there, look way in the back, the three-part comet paper, as it's called, which was published back in the early 1980s, which was a concentrated version of my 400-page book that came out in the late 70s. Anyway, on page 80 of part 2 of that comet paper, footnote 46, where I talk about the star-like characteristics of Jupiter and Saturn, I'm going to review those and talk about what we know today about those two so-called planets, which are really stars. And just to give you an idea also, what I was doing in 1979, 1980, 1981, while I was at Cornell University, and what is known today. So, you know, literally we're approaching the 30-year anniversary of this work. And, you know, how accurate that work was back then. It was right on the money and is probably more true today than it was then, if that's possible. At any rate, a couple quick comments right at the beginning of the show. I always try and mention a guy, friend of mine, Pastor Peters, a guy that is not your usual pastor. He also airs my show on his network, which airs on WWCR tower number 4, frequency 5.890. My show, of course, is on 5.070. And Pastor Peters has 24-hour-a-day broadcasting on the 5.890 megahertz frequency out of WWCR. And I just want to tell you a little bit, because like a lot of the talk show hosts, we talk off air occasionally, just trading stories and updating on what's going on, picking each other's brains as to current events, things like that. So one day, I don't know if I called Pastor Peters or if he called me, and I'm talking to him, and he said, "Yeah, I've been behind on getting my things done here." And he said, "Right now we're busy putting up hay," and of course he's a rancher. And he said, "Yeah, I got put behind on my schedule a bit because I was out branding steers the other day, and I forget how the accident happened, but he cut his hand, and he had to go in and get stitches, and of course then that put him out of commission a little bit in his branding of cattle." And of course, on his other tasks as being a pastor and, you know, running his network and doing his own radio shows. So this is the kind of person he is. He's not your average sit in a chair, do nothing kind of person. He's out there. He's running a ranch. He's got a lot of things going on, and he's quite the person. Let me just say it that way. So I'd encourage you to listen to what he's got to say. We also agree on a lot of topics, including the history of religion and the history of man. And those are huge, huge topics, understanding who you are and where you came from. And the little topics like why the Constitution was written and what it really means to you, something that isn't taught in the schools anymore. So anyway, I just wanted to put a note in at the beginning of my show, and of course my show is aired twice. Just go to his website, Scriptures for America, and you will get the schedule for my show, which is aired two more times. This very show is aired two more times on Friday evenings and Saturday, early Saturday morning. Once again, that's on frequency 5.890. And that just gives, of course, my show a lot more coverage around the world and at different times, making it easier for people to listen. A quick review of last week's show. As I talked about the main science topic, I talked about what I call the Great Deception. there's something in all of the new books, and this started back in the old talking to Alien Planet X days, if you recall those crazy days, that the Earth would end on May 15th, 2003, and of course it didn't. And there only benounced to NASA and a few people, there was going to be a great orange full moon that night. The first would come up, of course, in Japan, and then over the west coast of the U.S., and then eventually over the entire United States. And remember that the so-called alien communicating lady or channeling, whatever, the Zeta Quacker, saying that you will look up and see a great orange orb. And this was a tremendous 10-year plan disinformation ploy. And there were planned suicide, mass suicide events that were going to take place that night. And of course, none of that happened, mainly due to my being on top of that topic and letting NASA know that they would be responsible for these if they didn't use their power of the press to disseminate that topic and let people know that there was, that this was quackery, that that was going to be a large orange full moon, not Planet X, and that they would be responsible for these oncoming planned mass suicides, which were supposed to be splashed all over the headlines all over the world, crazy people talking to aliens, mass suicide. And of course, that was organized and managed for over 10 years, culminating on that May 15, 2003 date, to make the story of Planet X about as crazy as it could be. And it failed, much to my hard efforts. And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that the same disinformation crew is cranking up a new disinformation campaign, much better thought out this time, trying to get some legitimacy in it, and of course mixing in the alien topic when they can. But the one characteristic, the main characteristic, what I call the great deception, I'll reiterate it this week, was that on the cover of all of these books, the new ones that have just come out in the last year, the probably a dozen or so, and the Zeta Quack book, was the commonality was a large orange ball on the front to give you the image that that's what Planet X would look like. And then nothing could be farther from the truth, because what you will see if and when in the future a large object comes into the solar system, it will take the form of a giant raging comet, an electrical discharge comet, a plasma discharge comet, as it defined and described in my work. And that's what it would look like. And of course, they want to maintain this image of a poofy little dirty snowball that couldn't harm a flea. And that is the NASA front story. So those go hand in hand. And of course, you need the white hat cowboy, so-called do-gooder astronomer, tier three kind of no-name person to stand out there and keep beating the drum that standard science is correct, and this dirty snowball comet model is correct, and that McCanny is wrong about everything he says. And this is all part of the great deception, because the truth is, if Planet X comes in, it is not going to look like a great orange orb. It's going to look like what it exactly is, a giant comet forming a new planet in our solar system. So anyway, I just wanted to go back, listen to last week's show for the great deception. The great deception is in the disinformation knows that they have to leave images with people, something central that people will take away with them. So a lot of the new books have what you might consider legitimate information. So they will get on talk show hosts. A lot of people will promote them thinking, well, gee, this is legitimate information here. Not understanding that the great deception is right on the cover, that big orange ball, to fool everybody into thinking that that is what Planet X would look like. The great deception. So at any rate, onwards to a couple other topics. Econ 101. Now and then I talk about Economics 101, and of course this past week, They always do this over the weekend. The Lehman Brothers financial empire collapsed. And I don't want to go into economics so much, but I want to say that I talked about this long ago. I said, when the financial end comes, you will start to see the biggest players go down. And they will think that they're immune through this whole economic collapse. First, the little people will go down. Then the mid-range, middle-class people will go under. Then it will start to affect the millionaires and the people worth $50 million. And those people will start to go under and wonder how could they possibly go under since they've been such good Republicans. And by the way, I am neither Democrat nor Republican. I don't believe in any of the political party stuff that goes on in this country. It's all a big sham. But be that as it may, there's a lot of people, I call them wannabe Republicans, because there's only about 4,000 real upper-tier Republicans in this country who are associated with the banking cartel, the European banking cartel. So anyway, what I said is at the very end, these wannabe Republicans, the big shots who contribute and think they're immune to financial collapse, would start collapsing. And at the very end, the biggest ones would. And there you go, the Lehman Brothers financial collapse, Chase, the Morgan Banks, some of these that you would consider associated with the Federal Reserve and European banking and what's going on. All of their holdings are being taken over by the European bankers right now. All of the loans and equity loans and primary loans of the United States are being taken over by these bankers, and therefore they literally own all of America. Simply, as Benjamin Franklin said, or was it Thomas Jefferson, I believe, that said, through inflation and deflation, the bankers, if you let them in and run your financial situation, the bankers, through inflation and deflation, will own everything, and your children will not be able to buy the houses or land that we won and fought for and eliminated in the U.S. Constitution. So at any rate, that is underway, and the biggest ones are now going down, so the financial collapse of the United States is pretty much complete at this point. A quick note on disinformation hosts and sites. There, of course, a number of years ago, there were many, many more really good, solid radio shows on the air. And there was a point at which a lot of them went under. And here was the technique. They go in, promote these shows with advertising, get them set up with advertising. This is an old Lyndon Johnson technique, by the way. But the disinformation crew, the CIA, whoever you want to attribute this to, would go in and through their financial network, set up these radio talk show hosts, get them bigger and bigger, make them expand, get more affiliates, and they thought they were going great guns, so to speak, in promoting their information. And all of a sudden one day, and this all happened within about a month period, I remember when it happened, watching these talk show hosts go down one by one, day after day, just eliminated from the airwaves, and they would go in and say, you can have your show back, but we have control of the content of your show. And some of them bought off and are still on the air. Most of them wouldn't buy into that and went off the air. Some of them struggled for a while and then eventually went off the air. But anyway, the point is that today there are some very good talk show hosts. Pastor Peters is one I consider to be great. There's many other ones that have some good content. There are some entire networks that have good content. But they are getting fewer and farther between, let's put it that way. So I just wanted to let people know that the keynote of a lot of the shows is to have what appears to be alternative radio, but with a lot of misinformation mixed in, and sometimes it's not what they say, it's what they don't say. For example, what topics won't they cover? They won't cover Planet X topics. They won't have an open forum on Planet X, which is probably the biggest topic of our day or of anybody's day, because it's the thing that could rock our entire existence. and make people realize that we really have to be working for common goals. So information is very subtle, disinformation is very subtle in the way it's maneuvered and handled, and so there are some major radio shows that people listen to that they would never really understand are disinformation, but those are the sites that will fool you and be the source points for disinformation if big things go down. And along associated with them are what are known as phishing websites, sites that you go to and they have a whole plethora of subjects that you would click on and read articles about various topics. And what they're doing is cataloging you and the topics that you pick to read. And we call those phishing sites. That they're really phishing for information, who thinks what, and who can be put on this list as this thinks this way or that way or is revolutionary possibly or whatever. Those are phishing sites, many times associated with the talk show hosts who bought in to the disinformation program and still continue as if they are free and independent, but really are not. And that's one reason also why on this show I've maintained commercial free, because I support it myself by the things you buy through me, products like my books, DVDs, the water filters, and also, say, the one-time items like the corn seeds. You support my show, I pay for the airtime, and there's none of this infiltration. I've had many times people would come up to me and say, you know, Jim, I can really make your show big, we can really work together, and you could make a lot of money, and but you gotta buy into our program here and of advertising. And I just say, no, sorry, not the way I work. All the big money in the world, all the big offers, sorry, I'm for honesty, and I talk about what I want to talk about, the way I like to talk about it. And inevitably, early in my days, people would come up and talk to me like that, and you'd start to negotiate with them. And the first thing they wanted to do is say, well, now you got to have this person on your show, or this person over here has to be a co-host sometimes. And it's like, okay, get out of here. Go away, don't bother me anymore, because this is my show, I maneuver it the way I want, I talk about what I want in the way I want, and I see things with my point of view, and I give that, and the people out there understand that I've been around the block. I didn't read what I put out on somebody else's web page and try and mix it and pretend like that's my material. I've been around the planet, I've been around the block, and I've been kicked around it a few times, so I know how the world works, and I pass that on to you on this radio show. So at any rate, just a little note on that also. It's a constant effort here, and we've become accustomed to dealing with this. It's constant, where people try and take my information, twist it, put it on other internet sites or blogs, and then try and twist it around. And so it's a constant effort for us to clean those up. You'll find that my name won't be on Wikipedia, that great disinformation site. You'll find that the point is that it's a constant effort. Just for example, the corn seed project, we knew, and I knew, as soon as that I released that and gave that out for the public to purchase and to take the corn seeds and worldwide and make them grow and redo this corn genetic strain, I knew that immediately it would be there would be attempts to infiltrate that from the disinformation crew, from the people who try hard on a constant basis and are paid to try and infiltrate my good work. And so anyway, we caught them, and it's great. There's techniques that I won't talk about how we do it, but there are techniques where we can identify these people and get them out of there so that you, the honest people out there, the honest audience that wants to really partake in this, and make it succeed. You can succeed, and we route out these people. We found two disinformation agents in the search through the court orders, two complete disinformation agents trying to infiltrate and do damage to that effort. So anyway, it's a constant struggle, but one that is just part of what I do and is accepted, and it's just going to be there. It has always been there through my entire career. It's going to be there in the future, and it's constant. So the point is, I want to get real information out to the public, and that's going to continue. A quick note on last week's show, I talked about the lime that is put into the corn to create masa flour, it's called. And it's the lime, basically it's pure lime, and I did some more research on this. It's called slated lime. It's part of the process that's also used that the Indians in the Native Americans, Central South America, Latin, what we call Latin America now, or the pre-Columbian Indians, Native Americans of the United States, many of them lived in areas that were had a lot of lime in the soil. So, for example, many of these regions have limestone wells, and that's where the Native Americans actually got their water. So it already, a lot of the water already had lime in it. And I just want to liken this to a modern situation. There was a point, actually, when I was younger, and going back to the pioneer days even, people noticed that they would use salt that came from caves, and that salt did not have iodine in it, and they would get a thing called goiter. And so, of course, somebody noticed that, gee, the people living by the sea didn't get goiter. It was where, I don't know, some type of condition. And so the people living next to the ocean did not get this, so they identified it with sea salt. So the people living inland all of a sudden started eating sea salt, and they did not, and the goiter went away, and that particular malady went away. So I'm sure it didn't take long for the natives living here, and they were very astute to things like food and what was good for you and what was not good for you, etc. So they knew all of the plants. And of course, the way they would test a new plant is take a little bit, put it on your tongue, see what it did, and then they would start and make a determination, was it edible, was it good, and through trial and error, basically, they didn't really have chemistry back then, as far as I know. They understood what plants were good and bad and medicinal, etc. And of course, many of our modern medicines come from the trial and error of the natives who lived in these remote regions of the pre-Columbian world, in what we call Latin America now. But at any rate, the lime breaks down the skin of the corn when you put it in water, a little bit of lime, and it changes also, besides just making it more palatable, it creates the vitamin B3, which is necessary to prevent certain types of maladies in the human biosystem. And that's a whole long story in itself. I got a lot of feedback from people regarding that, some excellent articles. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time on this particular show. Maybe that would be a good show, topic for a future show. And by the way, there are still some seeds left if you want to order them. They're $15 for the 200 seed orders. Actually, you get about 300 seeds, I think, in there, but it's listed as 200 or 225. That's the minimum. That includes shipping to the 50 states. 2,000 seeds, enough to plant a 1/12 of an acre, is $55, and 5,000 seeds, enough to plant a 1/6 of an acre, is $110, and they all include shipping to the 50 states. So there are still some seeds left if you want to get in on that. I figure at the rate they're selling now, they will run out in about maybe less than a month. So if you want a mail order, that's fine. The mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota, 55392. Once again, that's $15 for 200 seeds, 225 seeds. $55 for 2,000 seeds, and $110 for the 5,000 seeds. These are non-hybrid, non-GMO, non-genetically modified, open-pollinated, original corn seeds. This is a dent corn. It's literally called, called a yellow dent corn, and is what would be on the family farm back in the 1930s or 20s or around the turn of the century, developed from strains originally from the Native American dent corns. Dent meaning is a little dent in the, each kernel when they dry out. That's where the word dent comes from. But at any rate, those are still available. And each, of course, comes with a write-up on the history of my project to disseminate these around the world and how to grow them, how to save the seeds, and all of the how to open pollinate the corn. All that instruction is in it, and of course that's all available on my webpage still. Also, so that's the corns. Like I say, at the rate they're selling, they'll probably sell out within a month, the next month, and then it'll be gone. Somebody asked, a number of people asked, if you could just scatter this seed in the wild and have it grow, kind of like, just throw it out there and let it grow wild, and probably it would not do real well. But it would be interesting to see if it would get back to nature, so to speak, and just to be a wild grain. But modern corn typically needs some pretty special conditions. You need pretty good fertilizer in the ground. It cannot compete well against other plants, so it has to be in an open area where it gets a lot of sun and not competing with other grasses, etc., that would be growing in a field. It has to be open pollinated. It needs a wide range of pollination in the field. So there's really a lot. This type of corn probably would not do well just throwing the seed out in the field someplace, and probably most of it would be eaten by little critters. So I believe that it has to be grown under managed conditions, let's put it that way. On to Hurricane Ike and the four hurricanes, Faye, Gustav, Hannah, and Ike. And just to trace what Ike did this week, it raced up very fast. It only took a day and a half to cross through the entire United States, also giving it very much an indication that this was a managed storm, let's put it that way, and manipulated storm, that's the term I typically use, because when it hit the Texas coast, it made a beeline for the northeast, going all the way up to Ohio and on up through New York and out into the Atlantic at record speed, and of course causing a lot of damage on the way, Ohio without electricity for quite some time because the remnant of the eye went right through those states, north of Arkansas and up through Ohio and then eventually up through New York, where they had a lot of wind and rain and remnants of that storm. But anyway, on my webpage, I called it The Perfect Storm. Now, there was a book called The Perfect Storm back in 1991 in November. Three hurricanes crossed over the continental United States, creating some of the worst blizzard conditions in history. And then those three storms formed out in the North Atlantic, the frigid North Atlantic waters, to form what we now call The Perfect Storm, after the book and novel by that name, and then the Hollywood feature film production, of course, The Perfect Storm. And that's what it was all about, these three cold water hurricanes, and then, of course, proving decisively that warm water is not the source of hurricane power. But at any rate, be that as it may, I said that Ike was another perfect storm. It did a lot of things. It was a manipulated storm. It came down and it did the final weather bombing of Cuba. They brought it up to a Category 4, I believe, before it hit Cuba. It ran right down the center, the main part of Cuba. Then it made a hard left, came out into the Caribbean once again, and gained speed and power, and rain and picked up a lot of moisture, and then crossed over that lower western tip of Cuba, part of that populated area there, and just weather bombed that area, which had not been hit by Faye, Gustav, or Hannah. So Ike did a real power play on Cuba there, pretty much destroying that poor little island. And of course, I talked about that last week, how Russia was doing maneuvers around there. So weather bombing is one of the most effective ways to damage an area, much more effective than military type bombing. And then they drew a line up to New Orleans again. Well, it allowed Homeland Security and FEMA to keep the indigenous people of New Orleans out once again. And, of course, that was one of the goals of Gustav, which failed. A lot of people remained in New Orleans. A lot of people left, but a lot of people just couldn't leave New Orleans and stayed there. And Gustav was not that terrible. It was pretty much a failure in terms of the ethnic cleansing that would be tried to, manipulators would try to accomplish. And so Ike had its beeline line set for New Orleans, and that didn't happen. It was going to become too obvious. Even people in the public were saying that was a little bit too obvious, manipulated storms, etc. Could somebody be doing this? And so then it swung over to the Galveston area. And note that neither Faye, Gustav, nor Hannah, none of them caused oil prices to go up. And that was the last role of Ike, was to drive oil prices up. So within hours of landfall, prices of gasoline across the country soared to over $5 a gallon when they were dropping. The price of oil was dropping. So that's why I called Ike, Hurricane Ike, the perfect storm, because it accomplished a lot of things for the people in control, including giving their oil buddies a good boost in oil prices. The big point, however, is that the standard news media has people really hoodwinked into thinking these are acts of God. Remember that there was no legitimate power source to drive these hurricanes. So they need that illegitimate, ridiculous warm water theory of hurricanes to rely on to make the people of the world think that these are acts of God and just out there creating havoc with the people. And so it's very important to have the Weather Channel and weather.com spouting this ridiculous garbage with what I call the pinheads over there. You see them on TV, they got a suit. They used to have those little skinny ties until I made too much fun of it. Then they went to the ridiculously wide ties, and now they're wearing these ridiculous long wide ties. I don't know what it is about those guys. I think they need to go to a different clothing store. Don't they pay them enough over there? I don't know. Anyway, but I call them the pinheads, and they're the ones that give you the incorrect weather news. But it's also the cover story for these storms, so that, and they've got, I would say, legitimately, they have pretty much the entire United States hoodwinked into thinking these are real storms. By the way, there's a big storm hitting the east coast of India as I speak, or just, I'd say it passed, it just hit probably a day ago, but still the remnants are of that storm are moving across westerly and across India. Beware of upcoming claims of asteroids hitting Earth. Of course, these start floating around the internet every now and then. We usually see these in May and June. But, of course, they can happen any time of year, and they always typically have the same amount of disinformation. Somebody knows somebody who knows somebody who talks to aliens, and for sure at this date, at this time, this asteroid's supposed to crash into Earth. And they always seem to have the same kind of, characteristics in these reports. They give a date, they give a time, but they don't give any real information. Now, if somebody were talking to aliens and they said, look, this asteroid's going to collide into Earth, well, that would take some pretty precise orbital information and calculations and knowledge of where that object was. But, of course, they never give that. It's just going to magically appear at this date and time and crash into Earth. And of course, we could be hit by an asteroid at any time. That's not impossible. But the point is that these disinformation ploys come out, are broadcast, people repeat them, people send them around in emails, they put them on blogs, they discuss them. And the thing that nobody ever truly discusses is this real information? And if it's real information, where's the orbital information? Because there's tons and tons of real good amateur astronomers around the world who would love to get this information, to observe it and track it, and say, yep, there it is, if it's there, you know, and confirm that information. But they never give that, and that's the key to knowing that this is just garbage information trying to distract you, the public, from doing what you should really be doing. There's an article that came out, and I don't know if I mentioned this before. Let me dig through my pile here. Here it is. Filmmaker, this came out actually the 8th of September. This was announced on Deutsche, on one of the German World News Reporting Agency out of Europe. It says, filmmaker urges international tribunal to probe 911. It says, Italian filmmaker Giulietto Chiesa was in Berlin recently for the screening of his documentary, which questions the official U.S. version of 911 terrorist attacks, has called for an international tribunal to probe the events. And I get a kick out of the German news media, talks about who's there, and the guy named David Ray Griffin, who of course has written a number of books dealing with all the inconsistencies of 911. But, and then they say that they advance conspiracy theories that contradict mainstream accounts of the 911 event. Well, I just wanted to comment on this term conspiracy theory, and that's a term that's been put on me a couple times, of course, but as it says right on the front of my webpage, conspiracy theory is a term developed by the disinformation crew quite a long time ago, many decades ago, and it was meant to label anything that contradicts the standard misinformation that's being fed to the public. So that's a way of labeling, and of course you'll hear in common discussions around the water cooler, let's say at work or whatever, where people might be talking about this, and somebody will always come out and say, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And that's, you know, and a lot of people who really don't know how to think, don't understand who the government is or what they are, will throw that out there to try and basically neutralize or minimize what somebody is saying. So anyway, that term, conspiracy theory, a well-thought-out term by the disinformation crew to basically minimize anybody who talks something besides the standard party line explanation. But it would be good to see an international tribunal get together, and as I said before, the Cheney Bush crew, who obviously has association with that event in some manner, in the cause and effect of that, that 9/11 event, would, you know, for a very long time be under the this tribunal investigation, which is really needed, obviously. Okay, quick announcement. This came out this past fall. Scientists, these are mineralogists and geologists, discovered, and this is an event that took place and has the same data has come from Arizona, New Mexico, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alberta, Manitoba, and now Montana. Now, those are some very diverse locations. Let me read that again. Arizona, New Mexico, of course, they're side by side. North Carolina, South Carolina, they're on the other side of the United States. Alberta is way up in Canada, Western Canada, Manitoba are way up in Canada, and now Montana, which is kind of, I don't know if it's central to those locations, but What they're discovering is the mammoths. Remember the big woolly mammoths, the hairy elephants, if you want to call them that, with the big tusks. There has been evidence found now in Montana for the same extraterrestrial impact event, and they keep calling it an impact event. But what they discover is that the mammoths died in a carbon-rich mat, they call it, or black mat, which is indicative of a tremendous forest fire, one that burned the entire North American continent. Black carbon glass is found in foam and material deposited in ponds, unrusted iron micrometeorites, and these impacted so that it's embedded in the bones and the tusks. Now, can you imagine how hard a mammoth tusk would be? Just like ivory, a very hard material, to have just littered and peppered with these micrometeorites. Also, the black carbon, little teeny balls of glass sprinkled all over this area, and of course, that's similar to the little micro balls that are found all over Mars. These came in, there were micrometeorites of glass or sand that came from outer space, melted and then solidified as they hit the ground and cooled. They look like very small marbles, and typically they'll have color in them because of the minerals in these little beads of glass, sprinkled all over the Martian surface. And obviously these came in from outside during the comet events. And so it's very interesting to see that these mammoths, and I know I've seen this from Alaska also, the same type of data. Look at this. Mammoth tusks contain rusty pits consistent with iron micrometeorites that were embedded and then rusted out. A sample of carbon glass in the black mat contains 62% carbon, 22% oxygen, 6% iron, 4% calcium, 4% silicates, and 2% aluminum. And they talk about various other archaeological sites where there's volcanic ash layers mixed in with the glass rubble. So you had all this material coming in, killing off the mammoths, impacting them to the point they were peppered all the way through to their bone structure and embedded into their tusks. Massive wildfires that covered the entire North American continent from North and South Carolina to Arizona, New Mexico, to Alberta and Manitoba, and all the way through the United States, killing off these woolly mammoths. And what I get a kick out of, though, is that these scientists keep talking about some kind of an impact event, which is not consistent with the data. This was a large passing comet. They never want to talk about that. Obviously, it was a large passing comet that basically destroyed this planet a number of thousands of years ago. And, of course, they put this at about 11,000 years ago based on carbon dating. But we all know that carbon dating is based on assumptions of average content of carbon in the atmosphere, which, of course, goes out the window because the entire atmosphere changed at this time also. So you cannot rely on carbon dating to date these events. At any rate, quick note here, once again, about water meters, electric water meters that they want to place on everybody's house and on everybody's water system. I just saw another article. This comes from a local newspaper. I was someplace, just picked up a newspaper and was reading. And it said what city officials expect is reduced water meter reading times for their staff. It reads precise enough to detect household leaks. They also have a Metropolitan Council directive that the city has to account for at least 90% of its water usage. Now, that directive probably comes from Homeland Security. And then they tell you at the end of the article that the newer water meters are designed to help customers analyze when and how they are using water. I don't really know anybody that I know that's really too worried about when somebody might flush the toilet in their house or when somebody might go to the faucet to get some water or, you know, to do laundry. I don't think it's in most people's schedule to run around trying to figure out what time of day they're using water and how much. This is all designed to identify people who are living in their houses after a catastrophe or after a government-designated shutdown. And literally, by opening up the tap water, these meters are so sensitive that if you took a half a glass of water, they would be able to determine that you are in your house, somebody's in your house, and they could send someone out there and say, you can't live here anymore. You see what I'm saying? So in a disaster, what this is telling me and what I'm telling you is that in a disaster, especially a government-controlled one, as is now happening down in New Orleans and in the hurricane-devastated areas, FEMA is in there. The reports that come back to me are that these are more like a military zone than a town trying to recover. But they can tell if you are using any water. And, of course, if you are, they can tell which house it's in because the meter is sending information from your house and the water usage. They can literally tell if you open up a faucet and take a half a glass of water, they can tell that somebody is in your house. And that's the whole purpose of these remote reading water systems. And in a lot of cases, they wanted them inside your house so they'd have a reason, a legal reason, to come into your house. Of course, just to examine the water meter, and they found anything else there, they could also. But the deal was to get into your house based on these water meters. Also, as I said before, they have the capability of reading the chips that are embedded in all the products that you use, the toothpaste, the electric drill. All of these products have a chip in them, and they needed some way in the house, in the residence, to read these and send information back to a central processing location. That's the water meter. Once again, the remote read water meter, the purpose of it. And the other purpose, as I said, is in case of an emergency, man-made or otherwise, to be able to identify who is in a house and who's, and by the fact that they know everybody has to use water. So the bottom line is, if you want to stay in your house after an emergency, you cannot use your water system. Go down to the basement, turn it off, and use stored water. Find another source, a creek out and back, or a pond, or something like that, and then use your water filter. And that's why I keep telling people, you know, if you do not have your own source of fresh water, you are going to be helpless. A good example, I got feedback from Ohio this week that the people's electricity was out for days. Well, of course, the food was going bad in the refrigerator. They went to the cupboard. They had one box of cereal and a can of tuna and were totally unprepared. They didn't have ability to get fresh water because the water, city water systems had been shut down because they run on electric pumps. So here are people totally unprepared after a natural event, which was Ike, the Hurricane Ike, the remnants, passing up through those central states, people still without electricity, without food, without water, completely unable to take care of themselves. So go to that webpage, my webpage, jmccsci.com, short for jmccsci.com, but don't try and spell it. Just go to jmccsci.com, and the water filters are there. You really need one in your house. Use it on a daily basis, and it's going to be there in case of emergency. They're portable. You can take them on trips with you. Don't leave home without one, as I always say. But at any rate, I'm really running over on all of the announcements tonight. Let's see. A quick going to the science topic. I'll skip the one on chemistry and outer space. It's a topic I've actually covered a little bit in the past. And I'll go right to the star-like nature of Jupiter and Saturn. I'll cover the chemistry issue again on a future show. But, like I said, if you have my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, in the very back, about, 10 pages from the very end of the book, It's listed as page 80, which is the original page number from the original publication, which was in the early 1980s. Footnote 46, it says, the following star-like characteristics attest to the fact that both Jupiter and Saturn are small stellar objects. Remember, I'm writing this in 1979. These are results when I was at Cornell University, Ithaca, New York, and I was these papers came out of my book that was published in 1979, talking about the star-like nature of Jupiter and Saturn. And so it says the following star-like characteristics attest to the fact that both Jupiter and Saturn are small stellar objects, with Saturn being much more active than Jupiter. This is a result of ongoing fusion triggered by energetic lightning bolts in their atmospheres. And then I go through a whole series of characteristics of these planets which show that they are star-like. They both have rings. They have ring systems just like the Sun. Here it says, all three have stable flat rings. The Sun has at least four such rings in its zodiacal disk. Jupiter has one thin ring, whereas Saturn exhibits an extensive ring system with energetic electrical discharges between the rings and from the rings to the planet, observed as auroral belts around the equator of Saturn. Interplanetary electrical discharges. Io of Jupiter, Io is the small moon right next to Jupiter. It's actually one of the Galilean large moons, but it's the smallest of the four large moons. It says that Io of Jupiter current sheet of 5 million amps has been detected. Dione of Saturn, as well as Saturn's rings, maintains a similar discharge. And comets which approach the Sun within the zodiacal disk form visible sunward electrical discharges, the sunward spike. Okay, the next point regarding Jupiter and Saturn, energetic particles surrounding Saturn is a plasma with particle energies higher than those found in the interior of the Sun. No known mechanism other than fusion could produce particles with such energies. So energetic particles around these planets indicates star-like conditions. The differential rotation is another point. Saturn and Jupiter's high-velocity equatorial wind belts correspond to the differential rotation observed in the Sun's atmosphere, the wind speeds in Saturn being over three times those observed at Jupiter, showing that, of course, that Saturn is much more active than Jupiter, being a very much more active little star. Okay, next point. High temperatures. Pioneer Saturn, remember this is back in 1979 when I'm writing this, and right after Pioneer went by Saturn, and probably about 1980. Pioneer Saturn measured the temperatures in Saturn's ionosphere to be 1250 degrees Kelvin. This high temperature requires an extensive energy source other than the Sun. This phenomena was also observed at Jupiter. Exothermic radiation is another point. Both Jupiter and Saturn appear very bright at certain wavelengths, radiating 2 to 3 times the energy they receive from the Sun. Saturn emits more excess radiation for its size than Jupiter. Okay, one more point here. Atmospheric conditions and lightning. The atmospheric circulation patterns of stellar objects are similar, with the violent storms producing energetic lightning bolts of both Jupiter and Saturn are energetic lightning bolts detectable as radio noise. The lightning bolts in Saturn's rings and in the atmospheres of Jupiter and Saturn are estimated to be millions of times more powerful than lightning bolts on Earth. And those are the main points in this article coming from the early 1980s, showing conclusively that these, what they previously called planets, Jupiter and Saturn, are in fact small star-like objects. But of course, if you believe, as standard science still does, that the fusion of the star is created in the core under high pressure, then Saturn and Jupiter could not possibly be stars. So they have to deny all of these star-like characteristics of Jupiter and Saturn to maintain that obviously incorrect theory. And so, once again, you have totally incorrect theories in science that have been maintained. Now, this is, as I said, pushing 30 years since this publication occurred. And for that length of time, science has been muddling around with this incorrect idea that the core of the sun is responsible for the fusion and therefore the heat. That's interesting because last week also I talked about the new CERN accelerator trying to smash atoms together, and of course the controversy over whether it would cause the Earth to be sucked into a black hole in the interior of this accelerator. But be that as it may, the whole issue here is that they're still laboring with totally incorrect concepts of how fusion formed and what fusion is. And those techniques probably will never result in a sustained fusion reaction. In fact, it's very clear also from my work back in those days that ball lightning is one of the obvious forms of fusion. It's a controlled reaction, and it takes on a superatom form, a plasma ball, where the nuclei and electrons, the orbiting electrons, actually separate, and due to their very high velocity, which is induced by the lightning bolts, for example, in Earth's atmosphere, some of the very energetic lightning bolts, will produce lightning balls. Tesla was recorded to have generated lightning balls in his high voltage generators, which still have never been matched even with modern equipment. He could get probably 4 or 5 times the voltages in the atmosphere than have been achieved since his time. He just had a knack for doing this type of thing. But as a result, he could create lightning balls or ball lightning in his laboratory. And they would float around and go right through the wall. Very interesting properties. And so you knew that these were very high energy plasmas. There are stories where ball lightning would come into a jet. I've heard of these where people were in a commercial jetliner, and the ball lightning would come in and actually float around the cabin where the people were, and they would observe this ball lightning, and then it would pass out through the wall again and back to the outside of the jet. So these are obviously a plasma down at the subatomic layer, and capable of basically just passing through solid material and maintaining their form. So that tells you one thing. These plasmas are on a subatomic layer dissociated, because even hydrogen would by itself would not be able to do that because of the electrons, basically the electron interaction. And so you're dealing with what we call a superatom, where the nuclei basically form a supernucleus, and then the orbiting electrons orbit around that, all at very high velocity. And of course, what you see is the light that is given off by this. And this is the exact same process that works in the atmosphere of Jupiter and Saturn and the Sun to create fusion, basically a giant ball lightning interaction in the surface of these planets, Jupiter and Saturn and the Sun. So at any rate, that's kind of a summary of what fusion really is, and that's why it's doubtful that any of these large experiments, accelerators, will ever obtain fusion, because they don't have the right components and they're basing it on totally incorrect science. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.